Welcome to an excerpt of the CME activity, Mineral Homeostasis in CKD, Mineral and Bone Disorder, Evolving Concepts in Prevention and Treatment, which is certified by Medscape and presented by Jeffrey A. Block, MD, David M. Spiegel, MD, Monroe Peacock, DSC, FRCP, and Kathleen M. Hill, PhD, RD. Dr. Block is a director of research, Denver Nephrology, Denver, Colorado. Dr. Block has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Amgen, Mitsubishi Pharma America, and CMed Group. He served as a speaker or a member of a speaker's bureau for Genzyme Corporation. He received grants for clinical research from Shire, Fresenius Medical Care North America, Genzyme Corporation, and CMed Group. He owns stocks, stock options, or bonds from Ardelyx. He served as medical director for Devira. Dr. Block does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Block does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Spiegel is a professor of medicine, director, ESRD program, University of Colorado, Aurora, Colorado. Dr. Spiegel has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Amgen. He served as a speaker or a member of a speaker's bureau for Amgen. He received grants for clinical research from Amgen. Dr. Spiegel does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Spiegel does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Peacock is a professor of medicine, Indiana University School of Medicine, Indianapolis, Indiana. Dr. Peacock has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Kai, Amgen, Carini, and Genzyme Corporation. He received grants for clinical research from Genzyme Corporation, Carini, Amgen, and Kai. Dr. Peacock does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Peacock does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Hill is a postdoctoral research fellow, Department of Medicine, Indiana University School of Medicine, Indianapolis, Indiana. Dr. Hill has disclosed no relevant financial relationships. Dr. Hill does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Hill does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. The purpose of this activity is to provide healthcare providers with expert perspectives on the relationship between kidney function and bone metabolism, including new data and strategies to treat CKD-MBD. This activity is supported by Sanofi. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.
Hi, and welcome to today's program. I'm Dr. Jeffrey Block from Denver Nephrology, and I'm joined today by my expert colleagues. First, we have Dr. David Spiegel. Dr. Spiegel is a professor of medicine at the University of Colorado in Denver, Colorado. Welcome, David.
Thank you.
Next, we have Dr. Monroe Peacock. Dr. Peacock is a professor of medicine at Indiana University Medical School in Indianapolis, Indiana. A pleasure to have you here today, Monroe.
Thanks.
And last but not least, I'm pleased to have Dr. Kathleen Hill. also from Indiana University School of Medicine. Welcome, Katie, to today's discussion.
Thank you.
We're here in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, at the 2011 American Society of Nephrology Kidney Week, and our goal is to discuss the clinical significance of new research data presented here at the meeting on calcium balance in CKD-MBD, or chronic kidney disease, mineral and bone disorder. Of course, data discussed here that has been presented as an abstract at a clinical meeting should be considered preliminary until published in a peer-reviewed journal. Before we begin, I'd like to also note that throughout this activity, I will ask interactive questions to gauge your knowledge of this area. When you click on your answer, you'll be able to see how your peers have answered. So, I would like to know how you would answer this question. What percentage of patients with CKD have mineral and bone disorders? David, to start us off, perhaps you could guide us how you would begin to answer this question.
I think actually, Jeff, it's a tough question to answer. First of all, CKD is a growing epidemic in this country, driven by obesity, hypertension, smoking, and lipid disorders. And the bone and mineral disorders of CKD depends a little bit on how you define it as far as what percent of patients have it. What we're realizing and what KDIGO has done is define what we mean by CKD, mineral and bone disorder. And what it's defined as now is a complex interaction of both laboratory abnormalities, bone disease, and vascular disease. And we know now that early on, there are changes, hormonal changes, that occur long before we see mineral changes in patients with chronic kidney disease. So very early on, we have PTH elevations in CKD, and now there's data also that FGF23 levels rise early in CKD. And we know that 125D levels also fall early in CKD. So those things happen before we see changes in calcium and phosphorus. So depending upon when you ask the question, what percent of patients have bone and mineral disorders, it depends on how you define bone and mineral disorders. Certainly, if you define it as an elevated phosphorus, then that occurs late in CKD, and only about 20% of patients will have elevated phosphoruses even as late as stage 4. If you define it as elevated PTH levels, then that percent is higher and occurs very early. What's also true in CKD bone and mineral disorder is that there are abnormalities of the bone, which probably also occur very early in chronic kidney disease. And KDIGO has given us parameters for how to evaluate bone disease in terms of turnover, mineralization, volume, and in children, at least linear growth of bone. And we know that CKD is accompanied with decreased bone strength, which is obviously the hardest parameter to measure. But the end result is we know that our patients fracture at a very high rate. And then in terms of the vascular calcification, that's also a common phenomena in patients with chronic kidney disease. It probably progresses as patients progress through stages of kidney disease. And by the time people are on dialysis, it's a very common phenomenon to find vascular calcification, both intimal and medial.
Now I'd like to ask the second polling question. In CKD, at what stage of kidney function do abnormalities in mineral and bone disorder first appear?
I think as soon as you can document that there's a decrease in GFR, I think you can show hormonal changes in a large percentage of patients, especially if you look carefully at FGF23.
Yeah, it's remarkable, isn't it?
Right. So in terms of the process of what happens in patients with CKD, we know early on that there are these hormonal abnormalities that occur, and we can sort of predict what will happen to these patients once they have a diagnosis of CKD. It's associated with very high mortality, and that mortality risk increases as CKD progresses, and by the time patients are on dialysis, in this country at least, they have over a 20% mortality rate. And the problem with this whole treatment of patients with CKD is that we have a lot of observational data. We have what I call observational risk data, which shows that if you look at the serum phosphorus, or patients with elevated calciums, patients with elevated PTHs, and now patients with elevated FGF23s, all have an increased mortality. So that's sort of observational risk data. And then we have another set of data, which I call sort of observational treatment data, where we have several studies showing that patients who get placed on phosphate binders early may have improved survival. Patients who get treated with active vitamin D analogs may have improved survival. And patients who get treated with calcium mimetics may also have an improved survival. But all the data is observational. So I think we're left with some very positive information, sort of a bright cloud, if you will, that we're understanding more and more about this kidney-bone vascular axis. But we also have a sort of a dark cloud hanging over our field in that we haven't done the large outcome studies to really guide us in how to treat these patients at different stages of CKD.
Yeah, I think it's remarkable, isn't it? We don't have really any outcome studies, whether it be in CKD 2, 3, 4, or 5, regarding the treatment of mineral and bone disorder with regard to tangibly affecting a patient outcome. And I think that one of the key things that you mentioned with regard to how we view CKD-MBD now is, in fact, shifting focus from those sort of composite lab bone calcification to the real meaningful thing, which is what's happening to your patients. Are your patients having fractures? Are your patients living longer? Do they feel better, right? Are they going in the hospital? Those are the things that we need to be studying that we're just not studying yet. So it appears that very early in CKD, probably long before they ever get referred to a nephrologist, we begin to see these abnormalities. And it appears from the data, I think from what you just pointed out, that regulatory hormones may be the first indicator of abnormalities in CKD-MBD. And you mentioned a few of those regulatory markers like FGF, and you mentioned 125 vitamin D. I have to say, I think that our understanding of this field has changed dramatically in the last 5 years. I mean, if you look at where we were 3 years ago to where we are today, our understanding of the physiology has changed quite a bit. And Dr. Peacock, I'd like to hear some of your thoughts on sort of how has our understanding of the biology, the physiology that's going on early, evolved over the last few years?
Well, I think it gets back to the central issue is that the kidney is the main excretory organ for calcium and phosphate. So an adult in balance is absorbing, say, 200 milligrams of calcium and 800 milligrams of phosphate, and most of that has to come out in the urine. And so as soon as the glomerular filtration rate drops, then the body still has to continue to excrete that amount unless absorption decreases or unless intake decreases. And so calcium and phosphate in the plasma increase. That sets up an alarm in the endocrine system because what they want to do is to keep calcium and phosphate concentration in serum normal because of the very vital actions of calcium and phosphate in tissues. And so then the endocrine system is alerted. Now, we've known for many years that when you decrease the GFR below, say, 60, then parathyroid hormone secretion is increased, and that leads to hyperparathyroid bone disease. We also know that the hormonal form of vitamin D, 1,25-dihydroxy-D made in the kidney, also decreases, and that eventually leads to osteomalacia. The rise in serum calcium and phosphate that occurs later certainly leads to ectopic calcification in soft tissues, particularly in blood vessels. So there's these three actions that occur. But if we look at patients who have early renal failure, and I think that's where the action is, in the last decade it has become obvious, first of all, that the normal population is moving into renal failure with aging and with a number of other conditions such as hypertension and diabetes. So there are many patients that we call normal who are in early renal failure. Yeah. And what it's come to realize is that plasma phosphate is a marker of morbidity and mortality in this population, and in the population, of course, who have established or well-recognized renal failure. The other thing that has, I think, really changed the field is we've discovered the hormone that actually regulates phosphate. It was unknown 10 years ago. Now we know there is this fibroblast growth factor, FGF23, which is acting on the kidney to do two things. First of all, to allow the kidney to excrete more phosphate and bring back down the phosphate, and also, very importantly, to regulate 1,25-dihydroxy-D production, which regulates the phosphate absorption. So I think all of this has moved the field into looking at what are the earliest effects of renal failure. And I think that's where the field lies at the moment in terms of not only interest in nephrologists, but interest to people in medicine and endocrinologists and dietitians and all the other groups who are interested in the healthy population.
And cardiology, right? I think it's really fascinating. We know we've talked about cardiorenal syndromes before, but focused mainly on when the cardiac pump function is altered, the kidney changes. And now what we're learning is that when the kidney changes early, these hormones affect the heart, right? And may play a role in why the heart ultimately fails. And in particular, I'm sure all of us have read with great interest this paper by Dr. Fall and colleagues and Dr. Wolf as the senior author that was just published in the Journal of Clinical Investigation. I think that that paper, I think, has, which is really solid piece of work, and Katie, maybe you can help talk about that a little bit, but I think it's really brought together this cardiac renal homeostasis, and it's centered around phosphorus, which is interesting.
Yeah, so this study published by Fall and colleagues in JCI just recently showed that in patients with CKD with the elevated FGF23, that's independently associated with left ventricular hypertrophy. And they showed through a series of very nice experiments in both cell and tissue that this is a clotho-independent role of FGF23, so not dependent on the co-receptor clotho, which is present and necessary for FGF23 action in the parathyroid and the kidney, and that it illustrates a causal role for FGF23 in the pathogenesis of left ventricular hypertrophy. So I think that this is important, showing this independent role, and that chronically elevated FGF23 levels in these patients is important for the high rates of LVH that we see in these patients and the high rates of mortality in individuals with CKD.
Yeah, you know what's so interesting, you know, David, you mentioned to it very early in your answer that the mortality is 20% per year in the ESRD population, but what's so amazing is that at GFRs of 45, the cardiovascular hospitalization rate, the cardiovascular event rate is 5 or 10 times higher. And we're talking about people with normal Chem7s, normal hemoglobins, you know, ostensibly look like normal biochemistry. But as you point out, Katie, this FGF paper sort of changes everything. It puts phosphate homeostasis sort of at the central or potentially central area regarding some of these cardiovascular events. And yet nephrologists in general are quite reluctant about how we manage phosphorus over the course of evolving CKD. And honestly, I think that's sort of where the hot topic is. So now that we have this wonderful piece of work showing FGF23 is related to LV mass, and that's likely to be related to events, how do we lower it? What do we do? How do we treat people with disorders of phosphorus, and what do we have available to us? And we know that right now, the only thing we have available are phosphate binders, right? People, it's the only thing we have any interventional trial on, even though it's never been looked at with hard outcomes. And Katie, maybe you can talk to us a little bit. You know, we have a number of choices of phosphate binders, and they have some positives and some, you know, some advantages and some disadvantages. And maybe you can share your thoughts on what those might be.
Sure. So there's the two main categories of phosphate binders are, of course, the calcium-based binders. And for the calcium-based, the commonly used ones are calcium acetate, which is 25% elemental calcium, and calcium carbonate, which is 40% elemental calcium. And with these calcium-based binders, there's always the possibility for hypercalcemia or perhaps progressing calcium phosphate deposition if that's present. And on the other hand, we have non-calcium-based binders, sevelamer, which is as sevelamer hydrochloride and sevelamer carbonate, as well as lanthanum carbonate. And these bind phosphate as anion exchangers and do not necessarily have those effects of hypercalcemia in patients. However, there are limited outcome data to suggest one use or one phosphate binder use over the other. There are some studies that have investigated mortality, vascular calcification, and bone outcomes comparing calcium-based and non-calcium-based binders. And while some have shown a benefit of using the non-calcium-based binders like sevelamer over calcium carbonate, others have shown no difference. So there's still uncertainty in the field as far as what the data is showing us. So I think we need more studies with those hard outcome data, mortality, fractures, to be able to determine which calcium-based binder or which phosphate binders are best to use.
Yeah, and you bring up a great point. I mean, David and I have done some of that work, and I agree with you. While some of the work points in one direction, there are some pieces of work that point in the other direction, and so there's uncertainty. But one of the things that you brought up with calcium versus non-calcium is, while we tend to think about serum calcium values as sort of the marker by which we should evaluate their safety, right? Are these drugs safe because they don't or they do increase serum calcium? I think all of you have done some work with regard to how much calcium actually gets into us. What's the calcium balance? As you said, Monroe, it's important, you know, the physiology is we try to maintain a neutral balance as you reach a steady state, the in equals the out. But when we provide this elemental calcium load in the form of calcium binders, I think we run into some potential problems. And I would love to hear, and one of the things I'm excited to see at this year's meeting are the abstracts that both of you have submitted with regard to calcium balance. We have had very little calcium balance data or phosphorus balance data in the last 20 years. So Katie, maybe you can share with us a little bit about, and Dr. your work with Dr. Peacock, on this and how you approach this balance issue.
Sure, and just to comment on something you just mentioned with the looking at serum calcium, and what I'll show you with our data is that you can have very high calcium, positive calcium balance, and serum calcium is completely normal and you haven't affected it. So we're reporting at the ASN meeting this year our results from a study in stage 3 and 4 chronic kidney disease patients where we measured calcium balance and phosphate balance in these patients while they were on a controlled calcium and phosphate diet. We've previously reported our calcium balance data in these patients at the American Society of Bone and Mineral Research, which was held in September of this year. And what we found is that while patients are given 1,500 milligrams per day of elemental calcium in the form of a calcium carbonate phosphate binder, there, as expected, we have increased fecal calcium. And you can see on our data slide that fecal calcium increases from 884 milligrams per day to just over 2,000 milligrams per day. Urine calcium, however, is unaffected. So they're absorbing a lot more calcium. They're getting a lot more calcium, absorbing more calcium, more net calcium, but they're not excreting any more in their urine. So that's a problem. And that results then in, of course, a positive calcium balance. So we can see that on placebo, when the patients were on a basal diet of around 1,000 milligrams of calcium per day, they were essentially in neutral calcium balance. But given the 1,500 milligrams of calcium from the phosphate binder, they went up to around 400 milligrams positive calcium balance. And this was a significant difference. So being able to produce a pretty substantial positive calcium balance by giving this phosphate binder. And we didn't see any differences in serum calcium, so we weren't producing hypercalcemia in these patients.
That's so fundamentally important, right, for how we treat these patients, particularly if we're going to start treating them early. I mean, the temptation, given the FGF data, is, all right, well, let's start using phosphate binders very early in the course of CKD-MBD. And I think we have to show a little restraint, because it's possible, until we do the clinical studies that demonstrate that's beneficial or not, that producing this sort of positive calcium balance may turn out to be, and I think, David, you might comment on that a little later, but nearly 400 milligrams per day positive calcium balance with a dose of binder that is used, clinically used. Yeah, that's fascinating.
Again, Jeff, this is of concern for the population with osteoporosis and the elderly.
Yeah.
And many of these are in early renal failure.
Yeah.
And one of the standard therapies is calcium supplementation. We hope it's going into the bone, but of course there's no way of knowing that it's not going into the soft tissues.
Yeah.
And so this is a concern also.
Yeah, there's quite population. quite a stir in that population. That's recently, right, with some meta-analyses suggesting, right, that giving calcium supplementation may not be good for cardiovascular risk. And I notice on your data slide, it's interesting, Katie, that even with 1,000 milligram calcium, you're essentially neutral or slightly positive. Right? Mm-hmm. I mean, but basically neutral. But certainly, if you start going up from there, one would expect. And I think your information on that serum calcium doesn't change is just another sort of point to be made, that we can't rely on that. And it may be true of serum phosphorus as well, that serum phosphorus does not reflect phosphate load or balance quite so well.
If I could make a comment, I think this is fundamentally important. I mean, we think of this when we think of potassium balance in CKD and sodium balance in CKD, and we know patients with CKD have limited ability to handle loads of potassium, loads of sodium, and we adjust the dietary intake to meet what the kidney can put out. And I think what we're clearly finding now is the same is true with calcium and probably with phosphorus, and we need to think more about their intake to match what the ability of the kidney is to put out.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
So we also have our corresponding data for the phosphate balance, and I think that this is really interesting too because you're giving a really quite high level of calcium, 1,500 milligrams per day, which you mentioned is what's used clinically, and the effect on phosphate balance is very minimal. So we gave a controlled diet of 1,500 milligrams also of phosphate in the diet, so this wasn't different between placebo or calcium. And fecal phosphate was unaffected. Urine phosphate was decreased with the calcium supplement, which is what you'd hope to see, but only by about 170 milligrams per day, so a pretty modest effect. And phosphate balance was not different. It was essentially neutral in both of the conditions of the treatment. So this huge effect on calcium balance and a pretty modest effect on what you're doing to phosphate throughput and binding phosphate.
Yeah, you really have to, it's great work, you really have to question sort of our sort of standard thinking and standard approach to what we're doing, and people have this perception that this is a benign event, right? Well, we've been using phosphate binders forever, and we'll just give our patients phosphate binders earlier, and what your data points out is there are absolutely some concerns that we need to be aware of in that regard. Let's move on a little bit. I think that, you know, when you can't talk about this issue of calcium balance, CKD, MBD, and calcium, non-calcium, without getting to this basic core issue of vitamin D and PTH and how do we manage hyperparathyroidism. You know, it's quite interesting that what you described earlier, both of you, that FGF seems to be one of the proximate reasons 125D3 goes down as you lose kidney function. When you reach end-stage renal disease, of course, we treat hyperparathyroidism with pretty large doses of vitamin D and or use of a calcium mimetic. And I think, Dr. Peacock, you're presenting or involved in some studies here that are quite interesting with regard to comparing how those two drugs work. Maybe you could tell us a little about that.
Well, of course, the management in the past has been to try and do a surgical parathyroidectomy or a partial so that you leave some of the parathyroid tissue in and bring down the parathyroid blood level. That's very difficult to do, and so we're very fortunate, I think, in having two classes of drugs which we're attempting to do, if you like, a medical parathyroidectomy. The first one is based on the 1,25-dihydroxyvitamin D, which one of its actions, in addition to increasing calcium absorption, it also decreases the secretion of PTH directly. And so a number of analogs have been developed where that is the main attempt to bring down the serum PTH and not to increase calcium absorption from the gut or calcium resorption and phosphate resorption from bone. So these are very effective. The second group are the calcium mimetics, and they're acting on a different mechanism. They're acting on the calcium sensing receptor, which is present in a number of tissues, but is present in the parathyroid gland. So the allosteric calcium mimetics, they are sensitizing the gland to the presence of calcium, and so they're decreasing PTH. But of course, there's two different mechanisms there. One is acting on the PTH directly, but also increasing calcium and phosphate absorption from gut, whereas the other one is just decreasing the PTH, but it's doing so in a pulsatile fashion. And so it's having an effect where there is kidney function present on increasing bone turnover markers. Mm. So they have a slightly different action, as one might think. And so further work is needed developing these two types of drug that would be ideal, where we've got a drug that only acts on the parathyroid receptor or in terms of the vitamin D, and the same for the calcium mimetic.
Yeah, there's a trial being presented here this week called the IMPACT trial, I believe that's the name of it, comparing directly the protocols which use vitamin D-based therapies with cinacalcet-based therapies. And I think much to many people's surprise, what these investigators found was that The parathyroid hormone suppression was quite good with both therapies, and if not even a little better in the paracalcitol-treated arm. And in fact, that the bone markers that you mentioned didn't really go in the direction that we had expected.
Well, if you look at the work in primary hyperparathyroidism, where we give the calcium mimetic, that increases bone turnover. And again, I think it's the pulsatile effect on PTH, which is anabolic to the skeleton. So I don't think the nephrologist should be so worried, because the bone markers go up. That may be a good thing. You're actually maybe stimulating new bone formation. So I think further studies are needed along these lines to see exactly what we're doing to the bone.
So I have to say, there is a trial that's been going on for roughly 3.5 or 4 years to really look at hard outcomes, as we said earlier, hard outcomes related to cinacalcet-based therapies versus standard vitamin D-based therapies. And hopefully next year, if we have the same conversation, we'll have some data to discuss if that trial finishes and we get a chance to look at it.
Again, there's the studies needing where we combine these therapies. Yeah. Again, this may be an approach that is very useful.
So thank you. That was excellent. And David, let me ask you, because I think you've done some studies as well with calcium balance, similar to Katie, and have participated in some randomized trials of phosphate binder use. I'd like to hear your thought, I guess, first on your having that experience. What's your particular thought on calcium-based phosphate binders, calcium balance, and its role in managing early CKD MBD?
So we had an abstract at last year's ASN on CKD patients, which is actually very similar to Katie's data in terms that patients, when they're on 2,000 milligrams of calcium intake, CKD patients are in marked positive calcium balance. So this, certainly the two studies seem to be finding the same things, and that paper is currently under review at the moment.
That's excellent.
So the question is, should there be a role, is there a role of calcium-based phosphate binders in any stage of CKD? And I think it's certainly possible that patients with CKD, if they follow our recommendations in terms of diet and restrict their milk intake and their dairy intake, it's possible that their calcium intake can drop really quite low. And it's even possible, I think, that some people could be in negative calcium balance if they're on a very restricted diet. And so there may be a little bit of a role in those patients for some calcium supplement or even for some calcium-based binders. But I think we have to be very cautious in terms of that administration. We have to know what their dietary calcium intake is, and we probably should adjust their binders to bring them back in what we think is a neutral calcium balance, which may be in the order of, 800, 900 to 1,200 milligrams.
Total
elemental calcium intake.
Yeah. And I think we're getting close to the end, but I'd love to hear. I know that you and I have worked together on a trial using these, and I think that maybe you could just quickly tell us about that trial design and what you think about the future of how we're going to make these outcomes better.
Right. So the trial you're referring to is called the phosphate normalization trial, and it's a very nice study, and obviously, Jeff, you were the one that spearheaded this study, and I think deserve congratulations for it. You pulled together a number of nephrologists, an international group of nephrologists, to help design the study and lead the trial, and then you pulled together industry to help sponsor the trial. So the trial itself is sort of a pilot study. The goal is to see if you can take patients with CKD who have slightly normal to slightly elevated serum phosphorus levels, randomize them to the three predominant phosphate binders, calcium acetate, sevelamer, and lanthanum, with a matching placebo in each arm, and then treat them for a period of 9 months, and the target being to get their serum phosphorus less than 3.5. The beauty of the study also is that you have measured urinary phosphoruses, fractional excretion of phosphorus, serum and urine calciums, PTHs, 125D, so all these hormonal, all these hormones that we've been talking about. And I think the study will give us a lot of information on these hormonal changes that occur when you place patients on phosphate binders, and hopefully will be a tool or foundation to guide us for what will ultimately be a large randomized outcome study to give us some hard information.
I completely agree, and I want to end with that thought. I think that the data that you all have presented is really clear. We need to focus on patient-centered outcomes as the endpoint of our clinical trials and not biochemical parameters. Drugs which may be effective in lowering phosphorus or modifying calcium or raising vitamin D are not the endpoint, and we need to do placebo-controlled randomized trials of these interventions. So as we close, I want to mention that as we move forward, and we all agree, I think, that we need to have earlier intervention, I think it becomes clear that the intervention is complicated. It involves diet. It involves social behavior. It involves food choices. It involves what kind of food choices can you make based on your income and where do you live and how do you pick medicines based on cost. And Katie, maybe you can just a quick word on sort of you already think about the integrated approach to how we're going to manage this moving forward.
Yeah, absolutely. As you mentioned, I think that we need all of the healthcare professionals working together as a team, the dietitians, the social workers, the nephrologists, the nurses, and really focusing in on the patient, too, and including the patient as the center of the healthcare team, so to speak, because I think the patient education is going to be very important, and that all of the members of the multidisciplinary team should work towards the patient-centered outcome, and as well as getting the patient educated to take responsibility for their own health and disease course. So,
yeah, you know, I think it's remarkable how often we blame the patient for this problem, right? We blame them because their body isn't behaving the way we want it to when we give them our medicines, and it turns out we need an integrated, collaborative approach with the patient. I agree with you at the middle, right? Because educating the patient in the nutritional is clearly how important the nutritional aspect of this is to what's happening to their physiology. Mm-hmm. So I think that the future will be an integrated approach early in the course of CKD, not waiting till they get to dialysis.
And I think that there's definitely a room for patient education too. There was a study published just last year in Nephrology Dialysis Transplant Journal, and they surveyed about 150 patients and found they were dialysis patients, and found that about half of them didn't know what high phosphate foods were, half of them didn't know what the consequences of high serum phosphate were, but encouragingly, 75% to 80% of them wanted to know more about CKD-MBD. So there's a want and a need there for patient education.
Yeah, they put our trust in us, and you know we need to honor that. Thank you all. Thank you, Katie. Thank you, Monroe, and thank you, David, for an excellent conversation about CKD-MBD. I hope you found this program of interest to the clinical management of patients with CKD-MBD. Thank you for participating in the CME CE activity. To proceed to the online CME test, click on the Earn CME Credit link on this page.
Thank you for listening to this excerpt of the CME activity, Mineral Homeostasis in CKD, Mineral and Bone Disorder, Evolving Concepts in Prevention and Treatment. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.